Armed vigilantes and militia groups are showing up to Black Lives Matter protests across the country. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, August 31st, we'll take a look at these groups and how law enforcement is responding to the threat of far-right extremism. Also, a New Jersey proposal to use baby bonds to help close the racial wealth gap in that state.
$1,300 is not going to be enough to really address the racial wealth gap. The accounts will need to be augmented over time.
Then how artist Megan Thee Stallion has put the spotlight back on intimate partner violence against Black women and women of color. And finally, how the tragic death of actor Chadwick Boseman is affecting you.
I can only imagine what it'd be like today to be able to play the Black Panther in those games again. I remember going to the movie and walking out and feeling like I was 12 years old again.
All right, let's do this. Last week, during protests in Wisconsin against police brutality in the shooting of Jacob Blake, a white teenager who was armed with an AR-15-style rifle killed two of the protesters and injured a third. In a video from before the shooting, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse said he and other armed vigilantes were there to protect property. In a subsequent video which captured the shooting and its aftermath, Rittenhouse throws his hands in the air, his rifle dangling in front of his chest, and walks toward police in heavily armored vehicles. Police, however, appear to ignore Rittenhouse, driving right past him. He was arrested later in a neighboring town and has since been charged with homicide. He's expecting an extradition trial in September. Rittenhouse's presence at the protest in Kenosha, however, are part of a larger trend. According to data that postdoctoral fellow Alexander Reed Ross recently shared with HuffPost, white vigilantes and far-right actors have also shown up at least 497 times at Black Lives Matter protests during the year. Ross's data also documents 64 incidents of simple assault carried out by the far-right at protests and 9 incidents where vigilantes shot at protesters. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we break down the relationship between armed white vigilantes and law enforcement. I'm joined by Michael German, a former FBI special agent and a fellow at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Alice Sperry, a journalist at The Intercept covering justice. Alice, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, let's start with you. There's been a lot of speculation about the ideology of Kyle Rittenhouse and whether he was connected to any specific far-right groups. What do we know so far?
Not very much, frankly. One thing that people have to understand is that there is basically no obstacle to joining these groups. If you wanted to put on a Hawaiian shirt and a flak jacket over that and carry some heavy weapons in public, you would automatically be representing the Boogaloo movement. These organizations don't have top-down organizational structure and heavy membership requirements. They're pretty fluid, and that's both by design, a practice called leaderless resistance that they use to because they understand that they're under police scrutiny. But also because they need members. They need people who will contribute or participate in these events. So if they start having any kind of rigorous screening process, they'll not have very many people showing up with them.
Michael, in the video of Rittenhouse, he's one of the videos at least, he clearly says that he's there to protect businesses. That's in his words. Michael, what is this ID? Who has deputized these folks? And we're talking largely about white men in these militias who are armed. Who has deputized them to come around the country and sort of, in their own words, protect people and businesses?
Well, that's just it. Nobody has. And these militants are acting as vigilantes, claiming to have a positive mission during the protests, but again, they're completely unregulated. They have no legal authority to be there. And as we see in many of these cases, it's not just a business hiring a security guard. Most states have licensing requirements for security guards, particularly armed security guards, because number one, you don't want people who aren't allowed to have weapons to be carrying out those duties. But also you want to make sure they have proper liability insurance for when they make a mistake. So this is not any sort of a legal operation at all, which is what's troubling about the police allowing this activity to happen. And they've done it so much for so long since over the last couple of years that it's not surprising that people believe that they're authorized to go out and do that. And that's because law enforcement has not been aggressive in tackling the legal violations these militants engage in while they're out at these protests.
Alice, when we see the video of Rittenhouse, which we described at the very top of the segment here, he, again, is walking hands up in the air, has just shot multiple people, killed two people, and these armored vehicles are just driving right past him. I mean, this was a stunning display of how law enforcement either, you know, willingly or not, just ignored this threat. How common is that, Alice?
I think law enforcement is quite comfortable with the presence of individuals like this and groups like this. And in fact, government has known about, you know, the threat posed by far-right, white supremacists, right-wing extremists for a long time, and it hasn't really done a whole lot to address it. And not only that, but we also know that the government institutions and you know, the FBI, for instance, have been very much aware of the close ties between these groups and these individuals and law enforcement itself. And that's something that the public has rarely been made aware of. It's something that, you know, the FBI is certainly not discussing publicly, even though they're very much on alert about this threat. We actually published a report in 2017, a leaked FBI internal document that warned that white supremacist groups and far-right groups were actively seeking to infiltrate law enforcement. And, you know, the document basically noted that domestic terrorism investigations often identified active links between these white supremacist extremists, militia extremists, sovereign citizen extremists, and law enforcement officers. But other than that, and this again was a leaked document, there hasn't been a whole lot of public discussion about this. And there's a reason for that, and that is a political reason. There were reports in the past that that kind of raised the alarm around this threat, and they were condemned. They were, you know, there was a big upheaval in response to those reports. The government was forced to basically walk them back. And so that's why we aren't seeing a lot of discussions or public discussions about this yet.
Michael, to Alice's point, I want to play a clip here from FBI Director last year, Christopher Wray, talking about the threat of white supremacist violence in the U.S.
And I will say that a majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence, but it includes other things as well.
Michael, are these militia groups part of what Wray is describing there in terms of domestic terror threats and white supremacist domestic terror threats in particular?
So the FBI divides their domestic terrorism portfolio into a number of different categories, and it had a separate category for white supremacists. When I was working undercover in the 1990s, they were one category, white supremacists and far-right militants, because there's a lot of overlap between these groups, again, with the low barriers of entry. But they changed that over time and had separate groups for white supremacists and far-right militants. It's a interesting way that Wray frames that, because what we have to understand is that white supremacists and far-right militants are far more active than any of the other categories of domestic terrorists that the FBI designates. So it's a bit of a subterfuge to say we do more investigations against these groups, and that's why in 2017, Senator Durbin introduced a bill, the Domestic Terrorism Protection Act, that would have required the FBI to produce the data showing the number of what they're considering terrorism incidents, and particularly the deaths from those incidents on one side of the ledger and the number of investigations the FBI has initiated in each category. So as a result of that bill being introduced, it hadn't even passed, the FBI collapsed its categories so that white supremacists and what the FBI had previously called black identity extremists were shoved into one category, so it would be unclear which group was more active and which group had the most investigations opened against them. And I think that was a way of hiding the fact that even though white supremacists and far-right militants are far more active than any other group, the FBI actually had a disproportionate number of investigations targeting groups like what the FBI calls eco-terrorists, even though there's no homicides relating to environmental activism in the United States, or these so-called black identity extremists, which again, there isn't really a black identity movement out there. It was a fictitious category created to basically lump any black militant into a single category to try to build up the idea that there was this movement that doesn't actually exist.
Well, and there's also, Alicia, I wonder if you have any thoughts on this, because there's also just the I think what was so stunning about the video is because when we often talk about what Michael's describing, you know, identity extremists here and the idea of who owns and walks around freely with guns and rifles in the way that Rittenhouse did. You know, the differences are striking. If we're talking about black people who are heavily armed, who decide to, you know, put themselves into a militia position, I don't suspect that the outcome would be the same with law enforcement.
Absolutely. And I think actually one of the most telling and tragically ironic things about the Black Identity Extremism report is that it was released by the FBI internally in August 2017, just one week before the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where we know a white nationalist drove into a crowd and killed Heather Heyer, a counter-protester. So I think just that episode tells you, you know, while the FBI was focusing on kind of concocting this non-existent threat and warning thousands of law enforcement departments across the country about the supposed black identity extremism threat, there was real organizing going on that led to real violence just a week later. So I think that kind of speaks to that disparity a little.
And Alice, what are some of the, in your reporting, what are some of the links that we know between law enforcement and themselves and some white extremist groups?
I mean, there have been a number of episodes over the years. I mean, there's been cases in almost every state. Actually, Mike just published a report about this. But in Los Angeles, for instance, there were members of a local sheriff's department that had formed a neo-Nazi gang in the 90s. In Chicago, there was a police detective that was rumored KKK member that was essentially like torturing hundreds of black men over decades. There was in Cleveland, there were officials that were found to scrawl racist and Nazi graffiti in their locker rooms. There are so many examples that we can think about. And just today, we saw some news actually out of Gotham. It's actually published a story about racist symbolism and language used by a precinct in Brooklyn. And even though not every officer is, you know, a member of the Klan, and in fact, a vast majority of officers are not, I think we cannot really talk about policing in the U.S. without talking about the racist history of policing in the U.S. You know, the police in this country started as slave patrols. And so from the beginning, policing existed to maintain a racial hierarchy in this country. And so we cannot really talk about reforming policing or addressing racial bias in policing without understanding that history. And of course, we're not saying every cop is a white supremacist, but policing as an institution was founded as a tool of white supremacy. And I think it has largely continued to function that way. And that's kind of what we're seeing on display in Kenosha.
Michael, you've had experience with this. You've actually, in 2018, police actually worked with neo-Nazis in California to pursue charges against anti-racist activists. How does that happen? And in your experience, how do those connections get made?
I think, number one, it's a loss of law enforcement intelligence. You know, in the 1990s, the police officers that I worked with understood that the tactics that white supremacists and far-right militant groups used, where they would plan a march or a rally in an area where they knew the public was opposed to their views. And they did that because they wanted to bring out their political opposition so they could attack them. And police understood that when these groups were going out in public like that, that it was that they were the instigators of the violence and responded that way, usually by making sure that those individuals, and usually it was only a small number, would not have the opportunity to attack the people who come out and counter-protest them. But somehow over the decades that have passed, it shocked me to see law enforcement not reacting to these rallies that way. And there was the Sacramento rally by the Golden State Skinheads and the Traditionalist Workers Party that went at just as these things are planned, where counter-protesters came out and the group attacked them and they were stabbed. A lot of counter-protesters were stabbed, several of them. But yet, rather than recognizing that this was a tactic and this violence was intentional, the police looked at the Nazis as the victims, and not just the state police who were doing the actual investigation of the rally violence, but even the FBI in a document later leaked. Number one, it erroneously attributed the group as the Ku Klux Klan, but then identified the Ku Klux Klan as a group that some people believe has a white supremacist agenda. And just that description of what has been the most notoriously violent domestic terrorist group in the United States history shows a strange kind of affinity for the white supremacist groups that has crept into law enforcement. And then we have since seen it all around the country. A Ku Klux Klan rally in Anaheim ended exactly the same way, culminating in Charlottesville, where, again, we've seen this aggressively militarized response to protests and Black Lives Matter protests in Ferguson, in the Standing Rock protests by water protectors.
One of the things, I was in Ferguson during those protests, and I feel like now the playbook is essentially ripped from the pages of Ferguson, where there are protests, there are counter-protests, local government then calls in national or federal aid, and on and on. And we're starting to see more and more of a pattern of that. I'm wondering, Alice, if you're seeing this threat, you know, why is it that many more white supremacists and other militia presence are happening to come to Black Lives Matter protests? I mean, what's the goal there?
It's interesting you mentioned it, because I remember in Ferguson, I was there also, and a few weeks in, you started seeing out-of-towners coming in, and you started seeing the Oath Keepers coming in, and kind of the scene that's being presented to us now was already, you know, it was already happening there. I mean, I think what we're seeing today is kind of amplified by the scale of the protests this summer, but also, of course, by the rhetoric that we're getting from across government, from the top levels of government. There's really an encouragement of this kind of action, almost like an inflaming of conflict from our president and others. But it's interesting that, you know, I always go back to Ferguson, because that's really where the Black Identity Extremism report originated. And to this day, there has been only one prosecution of individuals the FBI accused of being Black identity extremists. And those were two protesters, young guys that were essentially entrapped by the FBI in Ferguson. There has been no Black identity extremist violence. There has been no kind of real plot to threaten any kind of security. And yet there has been such a massive investment of time and resources on government critics and police critics and kind of dissenters, mostly Black and people of color, in the last few years. Meanwhile,
Michael, I want to just, before we end the segment, Alicia, I'm going to cut you off right there, because Michael, as we have 1 minute left in the segment, how much of a threat does this represent, particularly in the coming months as we head into a very contentious election?
I think it represents a serious threat that we need to keep in mind, and police departments really need to understand the threat posed by white supremacists and far-right militants far better than it does.
That's all for us today. Michael German, former FBI special agent and fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, and Alice Sperry is a journalist at The Intercept covering justice. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Megan Thee Stallion is one of the biggest stars in hip-hop today. From a recent collaboration with Cardi B to a major endorsement deal with Revlon to her song Savage taking over TikTok, it's been a banner year for the rapper. But her success also comes with a harsh reminder that misogyny is still rampant in the music industry. Recently, Stallion became the target of ridicule after publicly speaking out about being a victim of gun violence.
I'm not gonna let y'all keep playing in my face. So, since y'all hoes so worried about it, Corey shot me. You shot me. And you got your publicists and your people going to these blogs lying. Stop lying.
That was Megan on Instagram in early August, where she identified rapper Tory Lanez as the person who shot her. Initially, few celebrities and musicians came to her defense, with some even mocking or dismissing the traumatic incident and others dubbing her a snitch. For more on this, we're joined by Karen Atiyah, a global opinions editor at The Washington Post, and Elizabeth Mendez Berry, the vice president and executive editor of One World Books. Karen and Elizabeth, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen, what was the initial response to Megan's shooting, both on social media and from within the hip hop industry?
Yeah, so, you know, Megan was actually shot earlier in the summer, and there was footage, even video of her coming out of a black car, and she's bleeding from her feet on the pavement. And at first, we didn't know. She said that she'd been shot. She said it on social media, but we didn't know who did it. And initially, there was chatter on the social media, but it wasn't really picked up, you know, by larger mainstream media. And then fast forward, you know, Tory Lanez gets arrested, still speculation that maybe he was the one that shot her. And then when she finally came out earlier this month and directly said that it was Tory Lanez, that's when even still the response has still been one of, if not, you know, kind of ignoring the story, of not believing Megan, of saying she did something to deserve it, of saying that she was running around with the wrong crowd anyway, and just victim blaming. And it's just been really, you know, tragic to see, despite, as your intro said, she's had quite a successful year.
You know, this sadly is not new. Elizabeth, in 2005, you explored the links between cases of intimate partner violence among Black and Latina women and hip hop artists like Big Pun, for example. Can you tell us briefly about Pun and his wife?
Yeah. So Big Pun had been extremely abusive with his wife, Liza, and they had been together since they were 16 years old, which is when he actually started hitting her. And so after his passing, she was confronted with the possibility of continuing to be, you know, the first lady of Latino hip hop or telling the truth about who he had been and what he had done to her in its fullness, because she wasn't, you know, just critiquing him. She was trying to tell a story about cycles of violence and how they permeate our communities. And she did that ultimately because her children were replicating the violence that Pun had subjected her to. Her little son was beating up her daughters. And so as a result, she came forward, she told her story, and she was not only vilified and ostracized, but she was financially cut off by Fat Joe and others in the music industry, to the point where she eventually was in a homeless shelter and was forced to sell Pun's jewelry to survive.
Karen, let's talk a little bit about what your column talks about, which is some of the barriers that women of color, Black women in hip hop and beyond face when they're trying to talk about this type of intimate partner violence. What did Megan face in her case?
Yeah, you know, especially when she named Tory Lanez, she faced a lot. She did get a lot of support, you know, particularly from Black female celebrities. But people were calling her a snitch, a liar, a snitch, as if she was involved in some sort of crime ring along with Tory Lanez. She had just released her WAP video, which had been, which shot up to the charts, right? But was also criticized for being sexually explicit. And so part of it is this notion that sexually liberated Black women are less deserving, less worthy of protection. So people were, I saw on social media, people were looking for all sorts of reasons to try to explain why we should ignore what happened to her, you know, a bit of respectability politics in there. And so it's really, in a way, tragic that she had to kind of not exactly beg to be believed, but that she had to come out and, in the middle of her trauma, she had to go and to the hospital to get the bullets removed from her feet and have to just say, yes, believe me, please. And so I think the message is like, if a famous, wealthy Black woman at, you know, reaching the heights of her career needs to fight to be believed, how much more so for Black women, who, normal Black women, everyday Black women. And so I think that's what's so disturbing, why I wanted to write the column, is just to draw attention to this.
Elizabeth, when you were doing your work in 2005, you found that many of the victims of abuse that you talked to were afraid to come forward. When you hear the story about Megan Thee Stallion, does it sound familiar to you from your work back then?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say that. I mean, I think that the accusations that she is experiencing are so similar to what I witnessed, whether the woman was better known, whether she was lesser known. And actually, that they're the kind of accusations that regular people foist at other regular people in their own lives when somebody, you know, when a relationship abuse comes up. And so it's like a broken record, you know. And I think one of the things that is really interesting about this moment is that Megan has the opportunity to speak out herself, right? She's actually telling her story on her own terms. In 2005, when I wrote this piece, you know, many, many, many people chose not to come forward because they were afraid. And so, you know, I do, the fact that we're having this conversation on the radio right now, the fact that Megan is as prominent as she prominent now as she is, all of that gives me some hope. But I also think that misogyny is extremely persistent and extremely agile.
I want to bring up the fact that in Megan has said, quote, "He shot me and I still tried to protect him because the police be killing us." And there's a difficult choice that Megan talked about there, being afraid for her own safety, but also fearing that if she calls the police, and particularly women of color, Black women and Latina women, if we call the police on Black or Latino men, we risk not just snitching, but putting those men into a criminal justice system that already over-polices communities of color. Can both of you talk a little bit about that tension, Karen and Elizabeth?
Yeah, Karen here. So absolutely. And I think that that is what was so heartbreaking in many ways about what's happening or what happened to Megan, especially like in this year where police brutality against Black people and, you know, people of color, the Latinx community is in such sharp relief. All of America is watching what can happen to Black men who can get killed by police. So, I mean, in many ways, she has, this is just something that we keep in mind. And I know of other women who have thought about this. At the same time, it's like, that's the conundrum that many Black women face, is putting our safety and our security last, or being expected to, and basically protecting our abusers because we live in a racist society.
Elizabeth, your thoughts on that? Did you find that in your reporting as well?
Absolutely. I think it's a huge challenge. And I think one of the things, you know, as Karen suggested, is that as we start, you know, at the nexus of the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement is the fact that, you know, among police abuses, one of them is, you know, domestic violence rates are very elevated among police officers, likewise sexual abuse. And so the question is, how do we imagine justice and accountability in our communities outside of a criminal justice system? And as it stands, what they often, instead of doing that, what we do is just ignore and pretend it didn't happen. But I think we have a real opportunity here. And I think that will be sort of the next pivot for us, is what is justice, especially in cases of sexual violence and physical violence, gender-based violence, without relying on the criminal justice system.
Karen, what do we do in terms of, what's the role of the industry here, or fans, in terms of calling out this type of behavior, but actually trying to make change within the community?
I think what Elizabeth just said about other ways of justice is a really interesting point. I mean, I think about some of the other Black women in hip hop who have massive fan bases, like the Bay Hive or Rihanna's Navy. And I think part of what should happen or should have happened is that more people in the industry should have called out Tory Lanez, should have called for a boycott, should have imposed way more professional and reputational consequences, and conversely, perhaps a campaign to support Megan and to rally behind Megan. That's what I wish could have been seen, and which I think could have sent a huge message about what justice, restoration, and support could look like in this case.
Karen Atiyah is the Global Opinions Editor at The Washington Post, and Elizabeth Mendez-Berry is the Vice President and Executive Editor at One World Books. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know has experienced domestic abuse or needs support, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE or text LOVEIS to 22522. Last week, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy announced a proposal that takes aim at the racial wealth gap.
Inspired by the trailblazing work of Senator Cory Booker at the federal level, I propose today that New Jersey provide a baby bond, a $1,000 deposit into an account for every child born in the year 2021 to a family making up to $131,000 per year.
Governor Murphy's plan, which he's hoping New Jersey legislators will approve in the state's 2021 budget, would allow children to access the bonds once they turn 18. At that point, the value of the bonds would roughly be $1,300. That's according to data from the New York Times. On average, white families in the United States have roughly 10 times the wealth of black families and 8 times the wealth of Latino families. But Governor Murphy's plan is likely just a small step towards narrowing that gap. Joining me now is Derek Hamilton, the Henry Cohen Professor of Economics and Urban Policy at the New School in New York City. Derek, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. So happy to be on your show.
Thank you, Derek. And you're one of the folks who, you know, we've spoken over the years, and you've been, I guess some people would describe you as somewhat of an architect of this idea of baby bonds. So what was your initial reaction to Governor Murphy's proposal?
I mean, I'm very pleased. And I, you know, there was some more phrasing that he used as well. The word down payment, I think, is critical. And then also in that New York Times article, he said, we reserve the right to come back to these accounts and augment them with additional resources, which, of course, $1,300 is not going to be enough to really address the racial wealth gap. But because of the way state finances are structured, oftentimes appropriations are made on an annual basis. And I think the governor is clear and recognizes that the accounts will need to be augmented over time.
I mean, you said really what I was thinking, Derek, which is, you know, initially it sounds like a great idea. Some money rather than no money is always helpful. But really, $1,300 when you're 18, especially appreciating from 2021 on, just doesn't seem like a lot. What do you see as the most effective way of implementing a baby bond program with just that amount of money? I mean, shouldn't it be increased?
Well, again, I think the governor recognizes that in his plans he would like to, but because they're not the federal government, they are a state locality and they make appropriations on annual basis often. I suspect that this was intended to seed the idea, to get it started, and in the face of a pandemic, not just be defensive, but get on the offense and address economic security.
Do you expect that the New Jersey state legislature will approve a plan like this?
I think they will. I mean, I'm optimistic. I think the governor has a great deal of power sitting at the top of the top of seat of the government in New Jersey at the top. And, you know, again, they hopefully a progressive state like New Jersey really does take to heart that we have to be proactive if we really want to address economic security.
Derek, we've talked long for many years about the racial wealth gap in which we're not talking about income, we're talking about overall wealth, which is assets that families tend to have. And white Americans, on average, tend to have 10 to 13 times the wealth that black families do and 8 times the wealth that Latino families do. Should these bonds be solely set aside for communities of color to try and close that gap?
I mean, that is the most direct and parsimonious approach that if you wanted to address racial disparity to use race as the means test. But I suspect that the way the current Supreme Court and various other courts are constructed at this very moment, that becomes a high hurdle. Doesn't mean we should abandon those. I mean, indeed, I support reparations, but reparations would have to take place at the federal level ultimately.
Derek, you and a colleague, Duke University professor Sandy Darity, who I've also spoken to over the years, disagree somewhat on how far baby bonds would actually go in closing the racial wealth gap. He says it's not going to do enough. You say it will do enough, particularly when we're talking about the median wealth. What is the distinction that the two of you are at odds about here?
Well, you just hit the nail on the head when you said median versus the mean. If you're talking about closing the racial wealth gap at the mean, baby bonds is not going to address that problem. But if you're talking about closing the racial wealth gap at the median, there is Naomi Zweti, who has done projection studies, and when she looks at cohorts of children born at the same time, she finds a dramatic closure even within one generation when the accounts are fully funded. And so the question of whether the median or mean should be the metric, it depends on what the outcome is. I mean, true racial equity is when blacks and whites are similarly positioned throughout the distribution of wealth, at the 75th percentile, at the 25th percentile, at the 50th percentile, et cetera. But if we're talking about the typical experiences between a black and white household, then the median becomes the metric. You know why? Because of the skew associated with wealth distributions, regardless of race. America's wealth distribution is highly skewed at the top, where you have basically a white billionaire class that owns virtually everything in America. So given that, a goal might not be for black people to replicate a dysfunctional, distorted picture of concentrated wealth at the top that whites have, but rather to do several things. One, have a more egalitarian distribution of wealth, regardless of race, but then also ensure that one's racial identity is not determined on one's economic security associated with wealth, so that blacks and whites would be similarly situated throughout the distribution. So
I just wanted to interject there, because I agree that it shouldn't be, but sadly it is, because Derek, you and I know intimately that this is something that, you know, the racial wealth gap, I mean, we could spend a whole show talking about how it got there, but it essentially goes beyond the millionaire and the billionaire class through average white Americans who, again, not all, but the average, do tend to have more wealth in terms of home ownership and other things because of past policies. You know, and some estimates have said that it will take, you know, more than 200 years for blacks and whites in this country to achieve some sort of economic parity. So how do we achieve that? You know, are baby bonds just the first drop in the bucket here?
Well, you asked several things in that question. One, there is no silver bullet policy about economic disparity across race. There will have to be a package of policies. And then the second thing, here's to highlight the point about median versus mean. The mean wealth for white families is close to $1 million at $933,000. The median wealth for a white family is $131,000. Clearly, the typical white family is not a millionaire. So that is the point between mean versus median. Now, even when looking at the median, as you pointed out earlier, the disparities are dramatic. The typical black family is basically penniless. There is no wealth class for blacks, largely speaking, when we think about wealth. No middle class when we think about wealth. The typical black family, inclusive of home ownership, only has about $17,000. So these are all issues, but they're slightly nuanced in that you want to do several things. One, you have to address the concentration of wealth in America, period. So if we were, for example, to make a black billionaire class, that might be racial justice, but that's not economic justice. I'm for both racial justice and economic justice. We want blacks positioned similarly to whites throughout the distribution, but we don't want a concentration of wealth amongst blacks simply to replicate that of whites.
Derek Hamilton is a professor of economics and urban policy at the New School in New York City. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we're going to end this hour by talking to you about a huge loss to film and culture in what's already been a very difficult year. Last week, actor Chadwick Boseman passed away at age 43 from colon cancer, a diagnosis he had received in 2016. In the 4 years since that diagnosis, Boseman played myriad iconic roles from Thurgood Marshall to James Brown to Jackie Robinson to King T'Challa in Black Panther. That character turned Boseman into a larger-than-life celebrity.
I knew it was an opportunity to pull from real things, real achievements, real African culture, and place it in this movie to make it real.
The film Black Panther and Boseman's portrayal of T'Challa inspired a new generation of fans eager for innovative and inspiring portrayals of blackness.
When I saw the trailer, it moved me.
I want to know more about where he comes from.
Black Panther in the mainstream, finally.
It makes me think that I could be anything that I want.
And you told us what Boseman meant to you and your families.
This is Luis from Tarrytown, New York. And Chadwick Boseman for me represented a new vision, particularly as a man of color. When I was a child, we used to play superheroes with each other, and we always have to emulate superheroes who didn't look like us. And I can only imagine what it'd be like today to be able to play the Black Panther in those games again. I remember going to the movie and walking out and feeling like I was 12 years old again. And it's wonderful for my daughters to be able to have that kind of role model.
This is Angela from Chicago. Chadwick Boseman was very selective about what he wanted to portray, the images he wanted to portray. It speaks to his character and what he wanted to do, the legacy he wanted to leave. The humility that he showed when meeting with fans, working through pain in a private way, speaks up to his ultimate character, his ultimate bravery and courage, that he wanted to finish that work and finish those characters before he left this plane of existence.
Hello, my name is Dolores. I'm calling from St. Cloud, Minnesota. Chadwick meant a lot to our family. He was a representation of strong black men in movies. He was also a very big person in our family as a superhero. So when we heard about the passing of his death, we were very all set. And we've been saddened for a couple of days. But with that, we want to celebrate his life and what his life meant to our family and what it meant is Wakanda for life. Thank you.
Hi, this is Sharon from Pompano Beach. Chadwick Boseman, in almost every speech that he has given, he has talked about the responsibility of leadership, the responsibility of society, of individuals to step up and to be everything that they can be and for the betterment of society in general. And we need to pay attention. We need to heed, and we need to look inward and look outward to the community and see where we all need to be better, to do better.
Always glad to hear from you. Give us a call about your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And thanks for being with us on this Monday. We want to say hi to our new friends in Wisconsin at Wisconsin Public Radio and all across the state. We're glad you're on board with us. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. It's at thetakeaway.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. And of course, give us a call about anything. Leave us a voice message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.